Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Dr. Mark Farber and Ira Harris. Dr. Farber is the editor and publisher of a widely read monthly investment newsletter, The Gloom, Boom, and Doom Report, which highlights unusual investment opportunities, and he's the author of several books. He's also well known for his contrarian investment approach. He's also associated with a variety of funds and is a member of the board of directors of numerous companies. And Ira is a hedge fund manager, a global trader in foreign currencies, bonds, commodities, and equities for over 40 years. He's currently a CME director, was also a CME director from 1997 to 2003. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for having Richard, and thanks for allowing me to sit in with Dr. Farber, who I have had great respect for so many years. So thank you. It's a great honor.
Great. Thank you. And I thought we'd just jump right in with a discussion on the repo market or repurchase agreement market for selling securities and then buying them back generally within a relatively short period of time, a type of short-term borrowing. So questions on this market would be, is this market in a crisis? How and why is it happening? And what is the effect on the economy and the financial markets? So start with you, if that's okay, Dr. Farber.
Well, I don't think it's in a crisis. I think that the liquidity has shrunk, obviously, as the Fed was winding down its balance sheet. And at the same time, the issuance of treasury bills increased very substantially. And exactly why the problems occurred now, people don't know, and they didn't forecast them to happen. But the Fed obviously has come in, and they will provide the liquidity. In other words, they are buying these treasury bills. And they don't call it QE4, but in essence, it's essentially QE4. In other words, the balance sheet of the Fed is again expanding.
And do you see this as resulting in a potential asset deflation?
Well, the asset deflation is going to occur at some point because, as you know, we had in the 60s and 70s consumer price inflation. And since 1980, assets have been moving up very strongly. As you probably heard, there are now over $15 trillion worth of funds that have a negative yield. And that is some kind of a bubble. Now, can this bubble become bigger? And can interest rates stay low for a long time? Yes, possible. If everything is monetized, that's possible for a while, but it won't last forever. And the stock market and the bond market capitalization, if you take them together as a percent of the economy, has never been higher. So I think, yes, that there'll be asset deflation. In some cases, assets have already deflated. Say, very high-end properties in the U.S., in states where the property taxes are high, haven't been selling well. And in many cases, they're selling at maybe half of what the owners thought they could sell them 3-4 years ago. The asset deflation for sure will happen. It's happened in emerging markets already in terms of stock markets that have performed badly. And we have some real estate markets that have been deflating. We have some artists that are deflating while others are still inflating and so forth. So yes, it's going to happen eventually.
And would that asset deflation be manifested more in a nominal terms way or potentially just in real terms purchasing power?
Well, that's a very good question because you're right. In theory, what could happen is that because the U.S. could theoretically inflate, massively printing money and so forth, so asset prices in nominal terms may not go down a lot, but the dollar could go down a lot. It's like in Australia. Prices for properties haven't declined a lot, and some are making new highs, but the Australian dollar has depreciated a lot. So the depreciation has occurred through the exchange rate mechanism, and that could also happen in the U.S. eventually.
And what are your thoughts, Ira, on the repo market and this potential for asset deflation?
Well, I'm trying to follow this. So we see that the Fed has certainly embarked upon an effort to they don't want to call it QE, but as Dr. Farber points out and others have, this is certainly QE, but it's QE where they're, I think I've been trading it this way, and the way I see it is that they're ostensibly trying to steepen out the curves, because no matter what they say, when the curves flattened to inverted a little bit, they got nervous because they didn't understand why. But, you know, Richard, as we've talked about, and I know many others have for 3-4 years already, 5 years, that the central bank involvement has so badly distorted the signaling mechanism of the interest rate markets and the bond markets in particular to respond to actual policy that they've really lost their meaning. So nobody really understood as to why or what they were trying to tell us by this. So everybody who was out there going, well, this signals a coming recession. Well, I've studied yield curves for over 40 years, and I've traded them, more importantly, and traded them well. And I know it bothered me because we're seeing things that in some ways didn't make sense. So now the Fed has basically said, okay, we don't want these curves here anyway, because they weigh on the future outlook for capital investment and other things. So we better try to reverse this. And that's what they're trying to do. I'm surprised that they haven't moved more dynamically. But of course, then what Draghi did by re-embarking upon actual QE and adding to the European Central Bank balance sheet, it threw a little bit of a quote-unquote monkey wrench into what the Fed was looking at. So now they've just embarked, of course, upon trying to shift the curve, and as Dr. Farber says, very rightly so, front-loading by the Treasury, which I don't understand anyway, why they would put all that debt into the front end, into T-bills, which are not capital assets, which are merely interest rates, because they only run out to a year, and then after everything that becomes a note. So it now forces the hand of the Fed, which are basically just monetizing what the Treasury is bringing to market. So I think the market has really woken up to this, and we're starting to see Friday being a good example, is that the U.S. dollar is starting to soften a little bit. We saw the dollar index, which I'm not a big fan of, but market likes it, actually closed the week under the 200-day moving average, which has been unusual. We saw gold get another nice bounce following the Fed action on Wednesday. So it actually closed strong, even with the stock market performing well. So we have all these things where people say, oh, these can't happen together. They are happening together. Yes, the bonds. I like that the bonds were under pressure on Friday, because, again, it's the curve steepening, which is a response to what the Fed is actually trying to do. So as far as the deflationary impact, I don't know. I'm just watching it from the market impact And I still believe, and I think Dr. Farber has talked about this as long as anybody I know, that their fear of deflation really causes them to go down paths that are very dangerous. And it is the fear of deflation, especially as Bernanke laid it out. And, you know, it's why I tongue-in-cheek call him a 37er, because he has spent his life afraid of 1937.
And Dr. Farber, what do you see as the likely evolution of central bank policies and government fiscal policies as a result of all of this internationally?
Well, my sense is that we're moving to the left, and maybe Trump will be reelected, but then in 2024, it will be a new story. And I would expect, this is the longest expansion we ever had in the US, and it's also been the longest expansion in Australia. In the meantime, the global debts have risen a lot, and in the last 12 months, actually, the US government debt has increased at a faster pace than nominal GDP. So in the very long run, something is not quite right here, and something will go wrong. But my expectation is that before everything goes wrong, they will interfere with fiscal measures. They may call it MMT, or they may call it transfer payments or whatnot, or tax payments. Tax cuts for the middle class or tax cuts for the lower class, but they will transfer money, and that will boost the deficit, and that will then force the central bank to essentially print more money. I think once, when QE1 started, I said this is going to be QE infinity, because once you print money, you have to continue, basically. Once you stop, you run into economic problems. And since central bankers are here to postpone problems, not to solve them, they will continue. So fiscal spending will go up, and money printing will continue, and it will have in some areas a deflationary impact, and in some areas an inflationary impact.
And Ira, what are your thoughts on central bank policy trends and government fiscal policy?
I agree totally. And I think that Dr. Ira's last comment is, in some places, and I think in the U.S. it'll have major inflationary impact, because these people who espouse MMT, you know, their magic fix is that you'll have a responsible electorate. You know, most people forget that. But, you know, Warren Moser and Stephanie Kelton, they add that at the end, that a responsible electorate will ensure that the inflation doesn't get out of hand. Well, so much for a responsible electorate. So the impact in the U.S. will be inflationary. In Europe, I think with the ECB, it can be very deflationary, because you won't as easily get to a transfer union. And if the Germans balk with the Dutch and the Austrians and the Finns at a transfer union, then you are going to get a major deflationary event caused, of course, by credit. Because ultimately, and Richard, I've been with you where I continue to ask this question, and I asked it, I have to say, of Jay Powell directly in June of 2016, before he was chairman. I was at a meeting where he was at. Who guarantees the ECB? Well, he told me very forthright, they have a printing press. But if the Germans do not sign on to this, they won't have a printing press. And the fact that the whole European Union mechanism of the currency, and therefore the financial system, can fail, would unleash a massive deflationary default, because it'll be a credit event on the world. And that, I think, is probably the major problem, you know, that confronts the world right now until we see the way that Europe really gets itself together here. And it's, of course, they've placed it into the hands of Christine Lagarde because they believe she has the political heft to solve this problem. And of course, it'll begin with the issuance of a major amount of European bonds, not bonds, not oats, not BTBs, but an actual European bond. And we're not there yet. So that, to me, continues to hang over this market and prevents the transfer union that Dr. Farber talks about taking place in Europe.
And Dr. Farber, what do you make of what's happening in Europe with the European Monetary Union?
Well, I mean, I think it's a political issue, and they have made it very difficult or made it impossible for Greece to leave. That was a political decision, and they are making it very difficult for Britain to leave. In other words, I think the EU will stay. Now, will the one or the other country try to leave? It's possible, but most people in Italy or in Portugal or Spain, they're afraid that if they leave the EU, then the currency, their currencies that they would reintroduce would collapse, and so their pensions would be much lower. So actually, the EU is a construct that is likely to hold. I'm not saying it's a wonderful construct, but it's likely to hold. And if I understand well, the ECB belongs to the member nations, and each member nation has to put up a certain amount of money according to the percentages they own of the ECB. So the Germans have to pay the most, but the others also have to pay, if I understand well. And so their balance sheet is basically guaranteed by all the member countries. So I don't think they'll go bust or anything of that sort. But I actually think that the European economies have some recovery potential if emerging economies recover or when they recover, because the European economies are much more tied into global trade than the U.S.
And what do you make of that in terms of like a global economic slowdown? Do you see indicators of that at a macro level? And also in many of your travels, as you travel globally, individual situations, what are your thoughts?
Well, quite frankly, I think that at the moment, there's practically no growth. Do we have a recession? In some sectors, yes. I mean, tourism in Asia has slowed down very meaningfully. We have a recession in Hong Kong. We have officially a recession in Singapore. Mexican GDP was down. German export orders have collapsed. So there are lots of sectors that are actually in recession. And the commodity sector is not doing particularly well. Commodity prices are depressed everywhere. So yes, a lot of sectors aren't doing well, and you have demonstrations everywhere. There's the reason for these demonstrations. The demonstrations occur because ordinary people have a hard time making ends meet. In other words, their salaries are sufficient, but at the end of the month, they all have no money. And in the meantime, as you know, wealth inequality has grown a lot. And so the economic expansion that was driven from essentially the QE, the money printing, has been very uneven. For some people, it hasn't been very good. And for asset holders like Mark Farber, it's been very good. You understand? So it depends where you are. In the U.S. or in Europe, the wealthy people in Europe have done well because real estate is up and stock prices have also not performed as well as the U.S. They have badly lagged. But the wealthy people in Europe also own U.S. stocks, and so they've done well. The list of billionaires keeps on expanding. I mean, it's amazing. When I started to work in 1970, there were maybe three billionaires: Jean-Paul Getty and Mr. Ludwig, and the Rockefellers. But there were very few. And by 1980, there were eight billionaires, and now we have thousands of billionaires. Now the book, The Penniless Billionaires, this is very good. Because in some societies, money becomes worthless. So everybody's worth a billion.
And Ira, your thoughts on the global economy? Do you see slowdown indicators?
Well, we've definitely, I think Dr. Faber, of course, is right. We've seen a lot of slowdowns. It's interesting, though, as low as commodities have been, it's almost like they're getting ready, they're perking up here a little bit. And I'm not sure whether it's anticipation of Christine Lagarde and others being able to use their political heft to create the infrastructure programs that people are looking for, and maybe even out of China. I'm keeping my eye closely on copper, which has languished here. But there are definitely certain things, and certain indexes, commodity indexes, are perking up. But I think it may be response first and foremost to the fact that the Fed has totally pivoted. I mean, let's go back to where we were a year ago. The Fed was in, as we opened up this conversation, in Stanley Druckenmiller called the double shotgun approach, which is raising rates while embarking upon shrinking the balance sheet, which he warned was a bad idea, and I know others have warned too, and Dr. Farber himself has talked about this quite a bit. And this is a year we've had bond rallies. But I would pose this question. Seeing what we see, the possibility of a transfer union, I would ask to pose to Dr. Farber, what is the longest duration bond you would wish to hold, sovereign debt? Because I look at people buying anything beyond two years, and I laugh, but I must be missing something here. Outside of central banks buying, why would and I know that everybody has they have duration matches, but why would anybody in the U.S. buy anything outside of a two-year note? And I'm only buying two-year notes because the Fed is busy scooping up every bit of T-bills that they can. And there are a lot of holders of T-bills who won't even sell them to the Fed because they need them, and they need them as an interest rate movement. So I'll wait for Dr. Faber to respond.
Yes, that's a good question. As you know, when Argentina came out with 100-year bonds, they were bought by investors. And I scratched my head at the time, as did many other people, because Argentina defaults every 10, 15 years. So why would someone buy a 100-year bond? And these bonds have now gone down quite a lot in value. But on the other hand, you know, you and I, and most of my friends, when I go to conferences, I ask them the question, I mean, would you have bought a year ago a 100-year Austrian bond at the coupon of 2.25%? 100-year bond at 2.14%. And nobody would have bought these bonds, and yet they've gone from 100 to 100. They went to 200. Now they're back to around 180.
Yeah.
So sometimes we misjudge things. I think when interest rates peaked out in 1981, in the U.S. at 15% at over 15% for treasuries, and treasury bills went to 18. I think nobody expected ever to see 10-year notes at 1.4%, and this happened in 2016, and now recently again. I tell you why I would buy or why I'm holding treasuries of different maturities, including, I even have a 30 years. First of all, by holding a portfolio of bonds with different maturities, as time goes by, a 10-year bond becomes a 7-year bond, and then a 5-year bond, and so forth. So every year I have maturities come due. And I invest also outside the treasury market. I invest a lot in emerging market bonds. And the reason why someone would hold long-term bonds is actually the belief that in the U.S. they could have also, I mean, I think it's a bad idea, but they could also have one day negative interest rates. This has been proposed by several academics at Harvard and so forth. And if the economy really goes sour, which it eventually will, then we could have extremely low rates, extremely.
Ira, do you see that potential evolution in the bond market?
Well, I'm sorry.
No, you go ahead.
Okay, thank you. I don't think so, because when you start to measure it out, unless the dollar loses its status as the basically sole reserve currency in the world, then I'll differ. But as long as it is, I think going negative, I think, bears a lot of other problems that come with it. Yeah, we've seen them at zero, but zero, to go there again, the world will be in a certain, very difficult state. Now, with that said, if we go the way, as Dr. Farber says, of certain academics, now Rogoff and certainly Larry Summers and a few others who are pushing for electronic money, then all bets are off, because once you go to electronic money, you can go to 5% negative rates, 10%. What's the difference? Because all they want you then, they just want you to, then they'll have total control over what you do with your money. It'll be a very bad point in time, but there's enough people out there pushing for it for that reason, because we know that negative interest rates, it gets people to what Keynes warned about, you know, with the paradox of thrift. It's a little bit different, but that's where we wind up at, where people will start hoarding cash because I can't put it in the bank, so it doesn't circulate there, and I just hold on to it. Or I buy some types of assets where I just hold on to it, and they've realized this, that this outcome is viable, which is why you're getting the push for electronic money. And that comes fraught with all kinds of other dangers. So, yes, if we go to electronic money, the gloves are off and anything is possible.
And by the way, if you ask me the question, why would anyone buy a bond with a negative yield? I would respond as follows. At the beginning, you asked about deflation in the system. Say, if I'm an investor, and assuming I believe that stocks and properties and paintings and commodities and everything will drop by 30 to 50%, then I may say, well, in this case, it's maybe not such a bad deal to buy a 10-year zero coupon bond in Switzerland. I pay at the moment 106, and I'll get 100 back. So I lose 6 over the next 10 years, but I don't lose the 30%. So there is some people who actually buy these bonds, not because they have to. Insurance companies, they must buy some of these bonds because they have to invest part of the money in government bonds in Switzerland. But individuals, they think, well, it's a bad investment, but it's maybe not the worst investment. So you understand, that is their reasoning.
You know, can I, Dr. Farber makes a great point there. And I was going to ask him, so I'm glad he went that way, what he thinks about the Swiss franc. Because to me, the Swiss franc is a marvel that they've been able to do what they want to do. And they do it. They print all the Swiss francs that they want. And, they exchange them for other currencies, which they take and they buy equity markets, which is the greatest feat of alchemy in the world. But when I really step back and look, at least the Swiss have an exit strategy. Their exit strategy is that they can dump their equities, which are massive, I don't know, 700 billion, 750 billion at this point. They can sell those equities, get the currencies back, and then convert them back to Swiss francs when they really, so they at least have a viable exit strategy out of this monetary madness. Nobody else has a viable exit strategy, not the Japanese, not the Europeans. We certainly have seen the U.S. who told us, we had Ben Bernanke, yeah, this was going to be easy. You just let the stuff expire and roll down and you'll end it. You'll buy it in and that'll be the end of it. So you'll bring back the currency. Janet Yellen told us it was going to be like paint drying. It was going to be so boring. And Jerome Powell told us it's just on autopilot. And none of that, of course, is borne out. So I just want to hear Dr. Farber's view on the Swiss franc, because I know he's probably the most knowledgeable person.
There's not much you can invest in Switzerland, but you can buy Swiss stocks. And some Swiss companies, in my view, like other European companies, are actually undervalued or reasonably valued. You can buy a lot of stocks in Switzerland. They have a dividend yield of 4% when you have negative interest rates. So 4% or even 3% is a very high yield compared to less than zero interest rates.
Yes, yeah, so but I it's just...
There will be, I think, eventually pressure on the Swiss franc to go up. That's my view. Having said that, the price level in Switzerland is relatively high. Zurich and Geneva are among the, I don't know, three or four most expensive cities in the world. Life is cheaper in the countryside, but in the cities, these cities are very expensive. But the comparison is also sometimes difficult. You see, my brother, he lived in Switzerland and he had two children. Two children went free of charge to school, free of charge to college, and free of charge to university. So the tax he paid was actually not very high, considering that everything was free. If you're a foreigner and you don't have children and you live in Switzerland, you have to pay, the Swiss tax. But you can't take advantage of the Swiss social system, then it is expensive.
But, and this is the Swiss franc. And again, we're talking, and over the weekend, it was Friday, Saturday, Thomas Jordan, who's the president of the Swiss National Bank, and was trying to talk the currency down yet, more by saying, well, we can go to, even more negative rates, which in the short term does keep the Swiss franc from rallying. And in fact, when they do intervene in the market, which last month they intervened 10 billion. How do you know? Because they published the numbers for September. I haven't seen October's yet, but September, they printed 10 billion francs, sold them, and purchased baskets of stocks from all types of places. I think they're the second largest holder of Apple in the world. I think that's how large their holdings are from all this intervention. So they keep talking it down, but I thought the Swiss would eventually fall apart, but I keep moving to where you're at, which eventually the strength of the currency will be the best in the world, because their ability to exit from this Frankenstein of currency intervention will They have an exit strategy. Nobody else. There's nobody else I see with an exit strategy.
And overall, just taking everything into consideration, Dr. Farber, do you see the potential for a stagflationary environment with a slowing global economic slowdown and rising inflation, the potential for that?
Well, my view is that we will likely see at some point, and it may come soon, asset deflation. That would be my view. And we touched upon, you know, maybe commodity prices bottoming out and starting to rally. I think food prices are very low, and the agricultural commodities could rally. And you get mixed signals out of China, but I have some economists and services that seem to suggest that the Chinese economy is bottoming out and re-accelerating. If that happened, then obviously it would be good for the industrial commodities, from copper to zinc to whatever. So that could, if inflation picks up, I think the bond markets, the sovereign bond markets, are going to get hit very hard, particularly in Europe, where you have these negative interest rates. And that could then have an impact on the stock markets, whereby maybe stocks will do better than bonds. And then we have to look at what kind of stocks. As you know, there's an oscillation between growth and value. The last few years have been disastrous for value stocks and for active managers, fund managers. And I think the next few years will be relatively good for value and for emerging markets and for active management, and less favorable for index funds. That would be my view.
And Ira, just your thoughts on the potential for a stagflationary outcome?
Well, I'm not sure about stagflationary because, again, how does it get met? And it's going to be more difficult, I think, to define it in the way we always want to go back to the 70s, but the 70s were an anomaly in their own way to this situation. So I'm not sure I would use stagflation. I happen to agree totally with Dr. Farber as far as value stocks, and I agree with him about agriculture because, you know, the farmers in the course of the United States are complaining, but historically, if you look at soybeans, and this is with massive increase in supplies, because don't forget, South America with Brazil and Argentina and Uruguay have become much more productive producers of grain, but the Chinese have bent the entire food curve, and now India will bend it even farther because the amount of food that needs to be consumed in the world, especially protein, is that much more. And we've had phenomenal growing seasons, although this year in the United States hasn't been as great. And it is interesting watching the Chinese here, how good they're, you know, they play with Trump and Wilbur Ross and Lighthizer pretty well. But if they're buying more food, it's because they need more food. And I think that that's the fact, and the worry that the U.S. harvest is not going to meet expectations. Because I talk to farmers, and I go out, and Dr. Robert travels the world. I travel the farm country because I live in Chicago. And I'll get in the car and go drive around. And we've had not only do we have a terrible spring, the fall harvesting season has been just as bad. We've had the earliest snow, and not a little snow. In the last week, we've had 3 to 6 inches of snow, and there's still a lot of crop in the ground, and the fields are very wet. And I'll tell you tonight, where I'm sitting at, it's going to be below 32 degrees Fahrenheit. It's been cold. So one thing that they teach is that when good crops always get better and bad crops always get worse. So I think the Chinese are watching this carefully and are nervous that the U.S. crop is not going to be as big, and they're going to get caught out here. And there's one thing the Chinese can never get caught short of, which is food. So I'm very attentive here, and yet we haven't seen the move yet because it's all tied to the tariff discussion. You know, are they on? Are they off? What's going on? Is it a little bit of tariff? Is it comprehensive? Right now, there's, you know, news coming out as we're discussing. Wilbur Ross is busy talking. So I'm not sure it'll be stagflation. I do think that Dr. Farber's right, that asset prices, which have been floating on a massive sea of liquidity, will get some sell-off if other areas, especially value areas. The grain stocks, Bunge, Archer Daniel, the more international ones out of Europe, they've all been under pressure. They look miserable, and yet there's still significance, and they pay a decent dividend. So I'm looking for those. You know, I look at a company like Bunge, and you go, well, this was worth $90, $100, $110 not long ago. So, and they have a great presence in South America as well as North America and Europe. They're one of the oldest grain operations in the world. So I'm looking at, I happen to agree that the ETFs have seen their day. Passive investing was a nice thing when everything was based on liquidity. But if Dr. Farber's right, and I believe that he is, with the sovereign bond issue, and people are going to become more attentive to the price of money, which we haven't been for how long? For certainly since 2008 in the United States and 2012 in Europe, post-July when Draghi made his, you know, comments, whatever it takes. And of course with the Japanese, so we've had plenty of liquidity and still have plenty of liquidity floating around the world. So when that starts to turn, and I believe the Swedish may have fired the first shot when they said that they're going to be out of negative rates by December because it just hasn't worked. And they don't like the collateral damage being done. So as that starts to roll back, I think Dr. Farber is 100% right. And I will applaud him because most people who like to pick on Dr. Farber for his gloom forget that in March of 2009, he called the turn in the market almost to the tick, almost to the tick. And when he said it on TV, I sat up because, well, when somebody of that stature tells you it's turning, pay attention.
It's actually funny you mentioned Bunge, because that's the stock I own. I bought it recently when it was around 52. And I like it for the exposure to agriculture. And I also own some bonds of Minerva and JBS.
Yep. So we see the world.
Green price.
Yeah. So I'm looking for companies that I think will do well. And if we get the infrastructure spending, which I think is coming, I don't know how it's going to be done, but there are certain companies that should take, you know, great advantage of that. One of them, Dr. Farber probably, I think he'll agree with, is ABB, the huge engineering firm. That was, of course, originally out of Switzerland, but they're very well positioned if Europe were to actually embark upon massive infrastructure projects.
Yeah, and, infrastructure is an interesting sector. And, you know, particularly in Asia, the infrastructure will have to be built. And that will, of course, be very costly.
And just a final question, Dr. Farber, on precious metals, gold, gold's role in the international monetary system, your thoughts on that, and just gold, precious metals as an investment.
Well, I have an asset allocation, which is for dummies, essentially, including myself. You just put some money in equities and some in real estate, and some in bonds and cash, and some in precious metals and precious metals shares. And so I always owned precious metals. I started buying them after the 70s boom, when they had come down again to more normal levels. You know, after 1980, the gold and silver price collapsed, and then they traded in a range from, say, $250 to around $400 until 1999, when it started to pick up. And during all that time, I bought every month, and I'm still buying every month. I don't look at the price with terrible interest because I don't value it. The gold is held outside my portfolio. But I want to have a reserve because maybe one day the whole thing will collapse and gold will still have some value. And I think actually, given the negative interest rate we have and so forth and the money printing, I think the tendency will be for precious metals to go up in value irregularly, but the tendency will be to rise. And the one that I think is the most undervalued is probably platinum. Platinum usually trades at a premium to gold, and now it's at a steep discount. This is it only happens, you know, once or twice in 100 years.
Great. And your final thoughts, Ira, on the precious metals, gold?
There's nothing I disagree with at all with Dr. Faber. And I've been actually following his views on the metals because when we talked about that, I started trading in 1977, and I actually worked with Jim Sinclair for about 6 or 7 years, even though he was in New York, I was in Chicago. Yeah. So, and Jim and I still talk and communicate. So that's how far back I go following you, Dr. Faber. Because Jim was to me one of the best gold and currency traders that there ever was. And I learned a lot from him. I brought stuff to the table because I actually studied this stuff when I was in university. So, but it was quite a bit. So that's how far we go back. So, and the gold platinum, absolutely, and it's boggled people's minds for quite a while now. Because when I was first started trading, platinum was probably the most desirous precious metal in Asia. Because I'd say, who'd be buying platinum? You know, the Asians were watches. They used it a lot in jewelry. It's sort of been missing from the equation. But that too, things will turn around. And I think Dr. Faber's views on that are dead right on target. The only thing I would add is I look at this, and I know the silver's lagged relative to gold too, because, of course, we're up at historic levels, even at 84 ounces of silver to an ounce of gold, we're near historic highs. And I always wonder, and I will leave with this, and I'll wait for Dr. Faber to ask, will the Chinese come with a convertible currency that is somewhat backed by precious metals, by metalism, almost like Williams Jennings Bryan, but in order to gain that immediate respectability, whether it's a tenth back, five, because I know they're hoarding, the Bank of China has been hoarding gold, and they have a historical love affair, of course, with silver going back to the, prior to the Boxer Rebellion and the Opium Wars, when Britain tried to break China, did break China, to the depreciation of silver. So will they get even with the world by reinstating silver?
Yes, I mean, I think that the Chinese will, first of all, I believe the Chinese will introduce relatively soon some kind of an electronic currency, you know, based on blockchain, but it could be backed by precious metals, gold or silver or both. I think that's the idea. And I think the idea also, not only of China, but also Russia and other countries, is to diminish the holdings of U.S. dollars. I don't think the Chinese feel very comfortable with their U.S. dollar reserves.
And are you bullish on Russia, Dr. Faber?
Yeah, this year the ruble is up 8% against the U.S. dollar. Mm-hmm. Finally, the country that is in the limelight in America, Ukraine, the currency is up, I think, 12%. So maybe the Trump did some good propaganda for Ukraine and made it popular. But I think Russia has inexpensive assets. What you really need is a bull market in commodities.
Oh, yeah, of course.
But macroeconomically, they haven't been growing much. But the quality of growth has been high. The government debt is very low. And surprisingly, given all the sanctions and difficulties they had, they've done relatively well.
Yeah. Yeah, I keep buying RSX, the Russian fund, because it's hard to buy individual Russian stocks, but I do. And it pays a 4.5% dividend. And it's going up, and oil has done nothing but been stagnant to lower. So, anytime a stock that throws off something that should be negatively affecting it and keeps going higher, it's usually a pretty good sign. And I think the woman who's running the Russian Central Bank is one of the best central bankers in the world. She doesn't get enough credit, but she's been doing a pretty good job with running that central bank.
Well, that's rare. But
yeah, it sure is. Yeah.
Well, great. We'll end it there. It's been a fascinating discussion. How can our listeners learn more about your work, Dr. Faber?
Well, I have a website, www.gloomboomdoom.com. I repeat, gloomboomdoom.com. And I have two reports. One is the Gloom, Boom and Doom report, and the other one is a website report that is sent out electronically.
Great, and Ira.
Same notes from underground where I still write at, and you can go to Ira Harris, YiraHarris.com, and get to notes from underground and register, and you can get it when I do write, and through these podcasts. And I have to again say what an honor this has been, because Dr. Faber has been, I'm a global macro. Thank you. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.